Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, whether Washington is done messing up the American economy, philanthropy or government, which one is better, and bowling. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 11th of December. Great, as always, to have you with us, gang. So, the budget deal. Democrats get a little something. Republicans get a little something. There is no discussion of the debt limit in the thing or a tax overhaul or Medicare or Social Security. No grand bargain, capital G, capital B. But let me run this by you. Is it maybe possible that it's a win-win deal all the same because Washington is finally getting out of the economy's way? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer is on that one.
I talk to a lot of economists and policy wonks, and it's rare to hear them get this excited.
We reached a deal. I mean, how amazing is that? I mean, talk about a Christmas miracle.
Jeff Stibel is chair and CEO of the Dun & Bradstreet Credibility Corporation. He says the deal will boost the economy next year, and if it's passed right away, it could pump up holiday shopping.
You know, we had lackluster sales with the early holiday shopping, and I'm hoping this helps accelerate it.
Bernard Baumol is chief global economist at the Economic Outlook Group. He's excited about the deal in his own way. He doesn't think it'll have an economic effect until next year. But if Congress passes it,
then we're really looking at an economy that can grow beyond 3.5% with the unemployment rate dropping to below 6.5% by the end of next year.
Because Baumol says without the uncertainty of Washington gridlock, companies will climb off their piles of hoarded cash and hire people. But Congress needs to do more, according to Linda Bilmes. She teaches public policy at Harvard. She says to really rev up the economy, we need to tackle bigger problems.
The tax code is outdated. It is overly complicated. It is badly in need of an overhaul.
Bilmes would also like Congress to make Social Security sustainable. She knows this won't happen immediately, but she says there's a better chance for a grand bargain now when Congress isn't so preoccupied with short-term fixes. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
We'll now be spared, thanks to this deal, another government shutdown. That will come as a relief to, well, everybody really, but to especially to businesses that were hit hard by the government dysfunction of a couple of months ago. Lisa Goldenberg is one of those people. She's the president of Delaware Steel Company out of Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. We had her on the program back in October during the shutdown. Lisa, it's nice to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you as well, Kai. It's a real thrill as always.
First things first, how, now that the shutdown's over, it's been over for a couple of months, how's business? Are you back?
We're back, and manufacturing's moving right along. Inventories are at an all-time low. We've gone through several price increases, and
wow,
it looks like there's going to be another. So things are really moving along very well. The shutdown slowed us down. It was sort of an unnecessary stoppage. As I think we talked about, things are chugging along, and all of a sudden you put up a roadblock. So now the roadblock's been removed, and it's a little bit of the floodgates rolling. It's good.
It's interesting, first of all, that you have pricing power, but also that inventories are low. You're basically moving it as fast as you can make it.
We're moving it as fast as the mills are making it, yeah, and getting it to the distributor. Everybody's going just as fast as they can, which is really, really good news. People are coming back to work and not a lot of shutdown over the holidays is planned. It's very exciting.
Well, along those lines, then, let me ask you about January and February, because one of the things we wanted to check with you about is how you're feeling now that there is a budget deal on the table. You know, who knows if it's going to pass. There is some kind of certainty, which we all know businesses have been screaming for. Do you feel better? Are you hopeful? Do you have faith now that the government's not going to mess up the American economy?
Well, I never think the government messes up the American economy. We do seem to do a pretty good job of it on our own. I think we're all in this together. After all, we do elect them. True. Nonetheless, I think that they're trying to get out of our way, and that's a better way of putting it.
You sound amazingly confident.
I am. As you know, Kai, I'm an optimist.
Yep,
and
I,
what I can say is I know where we've been, and I know how bad it can look. And I think it's all taught us some lessons on the glasses half full. We could spend a lot of time talking about how things aren't the way we want it to be. On the other hand, I'd rather spend my time talking about where we're going and remembering how it could be.
Lisa, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. As always, call anytime.
Will do. Lisa Goldenberg at Delaware Steel. On Wall Street today, yeah, you're not going to like it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Obama administration shared some new numbers on the Affordable Care Act today, counting both healthcare.gov and state exchanges. 365,000 people have signed up for health insurance coverage, which is better, but still well below what had been expected. Back on day one of this whole thing, October the 1st, officially, we brought you a story about small insurers, many of whom expected to do a lot of business in the new healthcare landscape. Today, Marketplace's David Weinberg checks back in.
When I spoke to Howard Kahn in September, his company, LA Care, had only public insurance plans available, like Medi-Cal. But on October 1st, when the healthcare exchanges opened up, LA Care was one of many small insurers getting into the private insurance business.
We're anticipating hiring about 100 extra people just to handle the phones, the medical management, the kinds of questions, the billing that comes up, etc.
LA Care acquired an additional 50,000 square feet of office space.
We're looking at, during the first month, that we could possibly see as many as 20,000 or more members signing up. Could be higher. It could be lower, and it depends on how well the systems are working.
The systems, of course, did not work, and they're still not working. I visited Kahn last week to see how things are going 2 months in.
And so what was it like on those first few days when you had all these extra people working here?
Quiet.
The 20,000 new customers Kahn was hoping for in the first month have not materialized. LA Care has signed up just over 1,000 members.
I would say it's been bumpier than many of us expected.
To see exactly how these bumps are playing out, we walked across the street to the company's new offices.
For x-rays, you'll pay.
Call center employees are busy answering phones. Here in California, people can log on to the healthcare exchange website and compare plans. But because the site is broken, if they want to sign up for one of those plans, they have to fill out a 23-page application on paper.
What we could do is take them through an application by phone, and then we would mail it to them. It's a little convoluted, but we'd mail it to them. They would sign it, and they would then mail it into Cover California.
This process can take anywhere from 30 to 45 days. But despite all the missteps, Kahn believes the state will solve these problems soon.
Yes, we've made adjustments to our expectations in the short term. In the long term, we haven't made long-term adjustments to our projections.
On the other side of the country, in Baltimore, Peter Bielenson is having similar problems. He was the health commissioner of Baltimore for 13 years.
And then the health commissioner in Howard County for 7 years after that, up until a year or so ago.
Bielenson left that job to start Evergreen Co-op, a small nonprofit insurer that came into existence because of the Affordable Care Act. Evergreen set up shop in an 1870s reconstructed cotton mill overlooking a stream about 3 miles north of downtown Baltimore. Maryland is experiencing website failures, too. In fact, the day before I spoke to Bielenson, only 4 people had been able to enroll online.
That's just from the individual exchange, mind you.
When it became clear that the website wasn't working, Evergreen changed its strategy. Rather than focusing on individuals, it went after small businesses.
In the 2 weeks in which we've been approved for selling small group market here in Maryland, we have over 100 actively involved small businesses that are in the process, one way or the other, of enrolling with us.
Even with the unexpected small business customers, Evergreen can't succeed without a drastic increase in the number of individuals it enrolls on a daily basis.
overall, for the entire co-op, we need between 12 and 15,000 approximately, and we're quite confident we'll make that as well.
And like Howard Kahn in California, Bielenson believes the problems with the new systems will be solved in the not-too-distant future, and small insurers will be profitable alongside the larger companies that have dominated the market for decades. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coming up.
Actually, my best is in competition is 258, but I'm only a 172 bowler.
A little bit of 10 pin in a minute, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 129 points this Wednesday. That is 0.8%. Ended things at 15,843. The NASDAQ down 56 points, 1.4% there. Settled at 4,003. The S&P 500 unloaded 20 points, 1.1%, closed at 1782. First, the good news, what little there is of it. MasterCard charged up 3.4% today after it announced a 10-to-1 stock split. Visa added 3%. Home Depot hammered out about a 0.5% gain. Most stocks, though, in the red. Nike kicked off 3%. Yahoo down 2.6% today. Bond prices fell as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.85%. And you are listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace, so please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. How much did holiday shoppers spend on Black Friday? We'll see when the Commerce Department releases retail figures for last month. Bob Barker makes a special appearance on The Price is Right in celebration of his 90th birthday. And painter Edvard Munch was born 150 years ago on December 12th. He's well known for his work, The Scream. It depicts how you might feel about now trying to wrap up your holiday shopping. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Attorney General of the State of New York has some questions for cell phone companies. Eric Schneiderman wants to know why they're not supporting what's called a kill switch, where if your phone is stolen, you can send a message that turns it into a brick, basically making it useless for the would-be thieves. The mobile carriers are crying foul, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains.
Anthony Murphy works at a hair salon where...
My phone has been stolen 3 times.
Two of those times, he actually got his phone back by using a tracking app.
And I rode around the police car looking for it and tracking down my phone. It was kind of fun, actually.
But one of those times, he couldn't track it because the phone was turned off. That's why U.S. attorneys, including San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon, want a kill switch that would make a phone unusable and reduce the incentive to steal it. Samsung came up with one for its phones, but Gascon says cell phone carriers, including Sprint, AT&T, U.S. Cellular, and T-Mobile, all barred it.
We believe that one of the reasons why they have done so is because it really impacts their bottom line, their ability to sell insurance and some of the other products that they sell.
No, we have not rejected the kill switch.
Crystal Davis is a spokesperson for Sprint.
In fact, we are working with a number of handset vendors to work on a kill switch type feature.
A spokesperson for Verizon made the same claim. Both carriers say they want a kill switch, but one that works for all phones, not just one brand, and that having a different kill switch system for every type of phone is onerous.
Nothing's ever as simple as it seems.
Ian Gillett heads IGR, a wireless industry market research group.
We read all day about accounts and passwords being hacked.
He says a kill switch could be hacked too, and preventing abuse of that, whether by hackers or by an ex, takes time. District Attorney Gascon isn't buying it, though. He and the New York Attorney General want cell phone carriers to give them a written explanation by the end of the month. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Just in time for the Christmas season comes this question, courtesy of our Canadian friends. Exactly who controls the North Pole? Nobody, except for Santa Claus, at least right now. But this week, the Canadian foreign minister created a stir by saying his country plans to lay claim to the top of the world. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner explains why.
The claim may be a long shot, but Canada wants to prove that the outer limits of its continental shelf include the North Pole. Canada, Russia, the U.S., Norway, even tiny Denmark think Greenland, are all jockeying for position in the Arctic. Their claims to various parts of it depend on geologic mapping that will take years, but the region could be ice-free by 2030, according to some estimates. And that, of course, isn't just good business for Santa.
Our estimate shows that there is about 90 billion barrels of oil, about 1.7 or so trillion cubic feet of natural gas.
Alex Demas at the U.S. Geological Survey says that amounts to almost a third of the world's undiscovered natural gas and 15% of its oil. Not that any of it would be easy to get to, says the University of Calgary's Rob Hubert.
It's very cold. It will remain cold even in the face of climate change. Logistically, it's very difficult to supply, and it's deeper water than what we're used to.
But Hubert says 10 years ago, nobody thought North Dakota would turn into Saudi Arabia either. John Higginbotham, a former Canadian transport official, sees Canada's move as largely symbolic.
This government has never failed to pick up an opportunity to push the Canadian identity, Canadian sovereignty button whenever it can.
After all, Santa's address, according to the Canadian Post Office, Santa Claus, North Pole, Canada. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
We're doing philanthropy on the program this week, big philanthropy in particular, donors who have a lot to give, which is coincidentally what we're calling our series. We covered some of the criticisms that big philanthropy gets yesterday, both over the causes they support and the cost of the tax deductions that they get. Today, the edge philanthropy sometimes has over government in getting things done. Wealth and Poverty reporter Noel King has the story.
I'm standing on the side of the Hutchison River Parkway in New York State. Today, the Hutch is a four-lane highway, but back in the 1950s, highways only had lines running down the middle of the road. So at night or in bad weather, drivers clung to the center, dangerously close to each other. The story goes that one night, a rich man named John Doerr was driving with his wife. And she says, why don't we paint lines on the outside of the road as well, effectively creating driving lanes? Doerr pitches the idea to highway commissioners in New York and Connecticut, and they test it out right here on the Hutchison. It reduced accidents by a lot, but it was expensive. So Doerr used money from his own foundation to conduct more tests in Rhode Island, Ohio, New Jersey, and to advocate for his idea. Over time, he won. And that is why we drive in lanes on the road today. Tom Tierney is co-founder of the nonprofit Bridgespan Group. Its goal is to help philanthropists get better results. Tierney says John Doerr's lines in the road illustrate some of the advantages that philanthropy has over the government.
No one would suggest that government can turn on a dime, can start things and stop things and adapt things very quickly. Philanthropy at its best is highly entrepreneurial, and it's inventive, it's innovative.
He says there's a difference between this type of philanthropy and traditional charity. That idea goes back a century, when two of the world's richest men, John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie, were struggling to define what modern philanthropy should be. Judith Roden is president of the Rockefeller Foundation.
We found many, many letters in our archives between the two of them wrestling with this question. Is what we are trying to accomplish something different than charity? And Rockefeller wrote, we don't want to put bandages on weeping wounds. Philanthropy is about trying to solve problems at their root causes.
The foundation is still drilling down into root causes. And today's problems are big ones. Michael Berkowitz is managing director of a new Rockefeller Foundation initiative called 100 Resilient Cities.
100 years ago, 1 in 10 people lived in cities. Now over 50% of the world's population does. And by 2050, predictions are that 3 out of 4, 75% of the world's population is going to live in cities.
So when a city has a problem, like a hurricane or sectarian violence, it affects not thousands, but millions of people. Which is where the 100 Resilient Cities Initiative comes in. Here's Michael Berkowitz.
And this idea of resilience, of really bouncing back more quickly, of being an adaptable organization that is able to weather unforeseen shocks and stresses, this is still a relatively new idea and certainly a new practice.
The Rockefeller Foundation is choosing 100 cities across the world and trying to help them become more resilient. They're working with city governments to create a whole new job.
The chief resilience officer, you can think of him as mayor minus one, and we're going to pay their salaries for 2 years. In 20 years, we would hope that a city wouldn't run its operations without a chief resilience officer any more than they would do it without a chief of police.
The first batch of cities to get a resilience officer, including Medellin, Ramallah, and Jacksonville, Florida, are struggling with everything from chronic inequality to rising sea levels, problems that are going to take more than a year or two to fix. And here's another advantage that philanthropy has over government. In 20 years, the Rockefeller Foundation will be around to see if its plan is working. I might even be able to check in with Michael Berkowitz and ask him, does every city have a chief resilience officer? Rob Reich, who co-directs Stanford's Center for Philanthropy and Civil Society, says, unlike your average mayor, a foundation can't be voted out of office.
They're set up purposely to exist in perpetuity. So they have, well, an eternal time horizon. They have endowments which are meant to exist for a long time. So you can think over the 10-year haul or the 20-year haul.
Or the 97-year haul. I'm standing outside the Cahuenga branch of the Los Angeles Public Library, just up the street from my house. Andrew Carnegie, using money from his foundation, built this and about 1,700 other libraries all across the country.
It turned out they were super popular with citizens, who then didn't turn to the Carnegie Foundation for funding of every single library across the country, but turned to their either local city or town or state to create funding, and that became just a regular part of the public infrastructure.
Reich says a few years ago, California was having trouble funding its public libraries, and there was some suggestion that maybe foundations and philanthropists should pitch in. To him, that's a step backward. The job of a foundation, he says, isn't to bail out its old successes, but to find and fund new ones. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
As part of our series, A Lot to Give, we've built a tool on our website that'll match your charity habits up against famous philanthropists. So, do you give more like Bill Gates or like Oprah Winfrey? Just in lesser amounts, I imagine. Check it out, marketplace.org/whogives. Time magazine, as you might have heard, named Pope Francis its Person of the Year today. Time has been around for 90 years, plus or minus. Only a handful of magazines have been around longer than that. Bowler's Journal International is one of them, 100 years old last month, and going strong, despite bowling not being what it once was in this country. Keith Hamilton publishes the magazine. Mr. Hamilton, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
I confess to many happy memories, and this will A, date me, and B, tell you what a geek I am, many happy memories of sitting home watching the Pro Bowlers Tour on ABC with Chris Schenkel when I was a kid.
You know, that's what everybody remembers. I remember that. I grew up with my father watching that every Saturday afternoon around 3:30. I mean, that's what we did in America on, every Saturday.
And now, even though we do bowl by the millions, bowling just isn't what it was, right?
Well, bowling's not what it was in terms of being in the forefront mainstream media, but bowling's has evolved from a lot of organized play, mm-hmm. league play. There's still millions who do it, but there's a lot more casual bowling going on. People bowl for entertainment in these fabulous bowling centers with martini bars and lounges and deck areas. It's really a quite an interesting transformation.
I'll tell you, I went bowling over the holidays because we had a bunch of kids cramped in a house in, you know, 10-degree weather. There were no martini bars where I was.
Well, not everyone has those martini bars, but if you're building today, you're more than likely going to build what they call a family entertainment center. Maybe a little fewer lanes, but more things to do, with arcade areas, for instance. Then you have the older bowling centers. Actually, that's what I bowl in. I bowl in the typical bowling center that I enjoy and will go to probably for the rest of my life. But, you know, it's just it's an interesting metamorphosis for an industry in change, in flux.
Now, how has your magazine managed to stay in business for 100 years? I mean, who advertises in what I imagine must be a fairly narrow circulation target audience?
Let me put it to you this way in terms of the advertising base. When next time you go into a bowling center, whatever bowling center it might be, and you look around, you've got the lanes, maybe they're synthetic, maybe they're wood. You've got the masking units on the walls. You've got the pins. You've got electronics. You have the bar area. There's so many different industries that go into building of a bowling center that there's an advertiser for each one of those products.
But let me ask you this, though. I mean, in this day and age where kids, which is the market everybody's after because they're the future, and I get all that, but they can play with their phones, they can play with mom and dad's iPads, they've got Xboxes and PS4s. How do you get them to go strap on rented shoes and hurl a 16-pound ball or an 8-pound ball down a, you know, what is it, 60-foot bowling lane?
You do that through a lot of effort. I'm glad you actually asked about that. When I was growing up as a kid, I didn't bowl. But one reason why I didn't is because I couldn't. Every time I went to the bowling center, they were packed. They turned me away. So I didn't bother. But today's proprietors are trained differently. They're trained how to go after that youth market and how to cultivate them within a bowling center family. Now it is more of a business where you have to do marketing promotion, just like any other business. But the industry has recognized that. And in fact, there's 3,000 high schools out there that offer bowling as a lettered sport.
And there's Is that right?
Yeah, there's more college programs embracing bowling. Title IX has really kind of paved the way for women bowling. It's just a different model altogether than what we remember. And what we remember is always Saturday afternoons.
All right, before I let you go, when I bowled over Christmas, I was really happy with a 131. What's your best?
Actually, my best is in competition is 258, but I'm only a 172 bowler. I am definitely not a bowler that our magazine typically caters to. So, but I do my best.
Don't we all? Keith Hamilton and Bowlers Journal International. Mr. Hamilton, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, it's courtesy of LinkedIn, the professional networking site. It's their year-end list of the most overused buzzwords on user profiles, resumes, basically. So here you go. Responsible is number one. You're going to have to do better than that if you want to get a job, people. Strategy is second. Creative is third. All of them overused. So, hey, let's get creative out there. Shall we? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Wednesday. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, gang. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.